From Brown Cow Studios in Gallatin, Gateway, Montana, this is News Nerds. I'm Ezra Graham. During the pandemic, I learned to love cooking. I picked up a copy of The Art of Simple Cooking and started experimenting with salad dressings, pie dough, and bread. My guest today is who I have to thank for that. Alice Waters built her restaurant Chez Panisse off of the food culture in France, where she visited at 19, and the values of Maria Montessori. Waters focused on organic, local, and seasonal produce and paid the farmers, not the distributors, the price for their crops. In 1995, Alice founded the Edible Schoolyard Project, an initiative that engages students in growing and cooking their own food as part of school curriculum. Today, Chez Panisse remains at its original location in Berkeley after 50 years. Since the last time we talked in March of 2021, Alice opened a new restaurant in Los Angeles called Lulu with the former head chef at Chez Panisse, David Tanis, announced the creation of the Alice Waters Institute for Edible Education at UC Davis, and wrote a book. She shared with us today that she's organizing an event called Climate Food Hope on the National Mall this October before the presidential election. You might notice that I am recovering from a cold, and also this is our first episode since July of last year. Since entering high school, I've been recording less, but you'll still get some interviews like this every once in a while. It's Wednesday, January 10th, and this is News Nerds. After a trip to France that changed her perspective on food, Alice Waters became an advocate for sustainable agriculture and the slow food movement and opened Chez Panisse, a Berkeley restaurant dedicated to showcasing local and seasonal produce. Since then, Alice has founded the Edible Schoolyard Project, which partners with public schools to grow produce for education and use in school cafeterias, and recently announced the establishment of the Alice Waters Institute for Edible Education. Her latest book, We Are What We Eat, A Slow Food Manifesto, was published in 2021, the same year that Chez Panisse turned 50. So Alice, thanks so much for being back with us and taking some time out of your day to talk.
My pleasure.
So I just wanted to know, what are you cooking right now?
Well, I just finished breakfast a little while ago, and so I'm frying an egg, and a little salad, and having a corn tortilla that I just grill on the stove. And I have that with my Chinese pu'er tea, which is something that has changed my life. Drinking this tea is so good for the health, and I've made a lot of converts.
I do want to pivot to your work for Chez Panisse and your work with food, but I want to start with the education system. This is something that I really am passionate about in my own life. You've been working with the public education system with the Edible Schoolyard Project. Now there's thousands worldwide. But what was your own experience in the public education system?
Well, I grew up in New Jersey in the 50s. And I experienced education, and it wasn't exceptional. It was the way that schools worked back then, and kids went home and ate lunch with their families, or they brought food, and they all sat together and shared it. But I had teachers that were so passionate about what they were doing that they got me excited. And I still have a little bird that my third grade teacher carved for me. And I learned about birds by going on bird walks with her and her husband on the weekends. She took us all out into the woods. But I feel like it was that experience that connected me to nature very early on. And of course, the Victory Gardens from World War II. My parents had one. They kept it their whole lives. And I'm sure that as a little two-year-old child back then, eating strawberries from that garden was something very important for me. But it wasn't until I really decided that I would take a course in Montessori education. In 1968, I went to England to take that international Montessori training. And that's really what changed my life and my thinking. Because everything that Montessori believed, she learned from her time when she was a doctor in Italy in the 1880s. She wondered why children who lived in poverty and hunger, like in India or in Naples, could not learn like other children. And she discovered that they were sensorily deprived, meaning that our senses are the pathways into our minds. Our hands, touching, smelling, tasting, listening, looking carefully are the ways that we receive information effectively. And of course, living in this fast food world that we live in, we aren't using our senses. And it's changed the whole experience of education as well. So I feel like eating is one of those places where we use our hands and taste and smell, listen to the sounds of cooking, look at the beautiful food. And I thought when the principal of King's School in Berkeley, a middle school in Berkeley with 1,000 kids, when the principal called me up and asked if I could come and help him beautify his school, I, of course, said yes. And I went over there, and it all began the Edible Schoolyard Project. But we weren't just going to build a garden and a kitchen for teaching the academic subjects. We would be, of course, teaching gardening and cooking at the same time. And the kids just loved the classes because they were interactive. They didn't feel like it was a geography class studying the Middle East when you were cooking hummus and pita bread and you were talking about what kind of climate was in the Middle East and what things they could grow. And you were learning where it was placed in the rest of the world. So it gave you the sensorial experience of being in the Middle East.
So you went to school at UC Berkeley, but then you stayed and started Chez Panisse. And at the same time that you were there, there was a civil rights and free speech movement, and Berkeley really became known for that. Do you think that the civil rights and free speech movement there helped to contribute to the atmosphere in Chez Panisse?
No question, because I arrived in Berkeley in 1964 when the big demonstrations were happening and Mario Savio was speaking. And he said, if we all get together, we can change the world. So that became really instilled inside of me. And I became an activist and I decided to go to France in 1965 because he also encouraged me and all of us to learn from other cultures, to experience education in a very big way, not to decide what your major was and how you had to make money, but to experience the world. So I went to France and it really changed my life. I tasted this food like I never tasted before. And so when I came back from France after a year, I said, I want to live like the French. And radically, I suppose, I thought I could open a restaurant when I never had done it before and got together a group of friends who love to cook. And we found an old house that was in a business area of Berkeley where the cheese board and the coffee shop around the corner already were well established. And we decided to make a restaurant and maybe the food would come. Naively, I thought that. But in fact, we ended up at the doorsteps of the local organic and, in fact, regenerative farmers. Bob Kennard was our first farmer, and he grew cover crops and he did all of those things. He didn't want to be considered even organic because he felt like he was beyond organic.
You were talking about Bob Kennard, and you've also talked to me about your family, and you had a mom that cooked, but I think that what you've done with Chez Panisse was more that you got in your early childhood. But then they helped you to find Bob Kennard. They toured a bunch of farms, they found him, and then they brought him to you. Do you think that Chez Panisse brought your family closer?
No question about it. I just didn't know my father as an adult because he was always working with Prudential Insurance. I just didn't know him for who he really was growing up. And when I met him, when they moved to Berkeley and he started working at the University of California, I really understood his passion for gardening, and I loved the way that he understood running businesses because it was the workers' side that he was expressing to us that people needed to work together to make something happen. And so he was amazing in the early years, and he saw the struggle I was having about finding food. And he went to Davis and asked for all of the organic farms within 1 hour of Chez Panisse. And then he spent about 6 months with my mother traveling around, visiting the farms. Then he came back and he said, there are two or three that are great, but Bob Kennard's probably the one that can work with you most effectively.
There's been a lot of talk about the dynamic in a kitchen and how different chefs and owners of these restaurants cultivate that. Did you actively try to seek a certain dynamic in the kitchen that was conducive to what you were trying to do?
I did. I applied Montessori principles to the restaurant from the very beginning. I wanted it to smell good. I wanted it to be beautiful. I wanted not loud noise. I wanted people to be able to talk. And it's so great when we open the kitchen and the dining room into one room. We only had one menu from the very beginning. So people came and they had to really like what we were doing. And we wanted them to see what was happening in the kitchen. So it was important that the kitchen be beautiful too. We always had platters of food that we were cooking on the tables. We had a fireplace. We have a fireplace in the kitchen. But I always have thought that kitchens need to express the values that you cherish. And certainly beauty is one of them, but collaboration is very important to me. We're trying every day to make something that's greater than the sum of the parts, something that we haven't cooked before, or we thought of a new way to make it better. And that's kind of the way it's been run for all these years.
In your book, you split it into two. So you talk about fast food ideals and then slow food ideals. Do you see slow food as a return to tradition and what we've been doing for thousands of years, or innovation?
It's of course what we've been doing for thousands of years. We've been eating locally. We've been having gardens. We've been getting our food from farmers markets. I mean, we've been doing this around the world forever, and no pesticides or herbicides. It's only been since about 1950, after World War II, that we imported food other than coffee, tea, and spices. And that changed our world. And it came about, my theory is, that we started to eat fast food because it was fast, cheap, and easy. And in this country, we didn't have the values of our culture, the deep values that are present in other cultures around the world, because the United States was relatively new and it was established by a lot of Puritans that were not engaged with food at the table. They grew food for quantity rather than quality.
So when you see new fast food chains, I'm thinking of Chipotle and what Steve Ells has been doing that have taken more of a stance about ingredients over efficiency, but also, of course, it's still fast food. What do you think of those kind of change?
Well, I think it's important to support the local people that are farming organically, regeneratively, because that is a way to directly address climate change. And so big companies that change the way they purchase their food are extremely important right now for climate and for nutrition. So, as much as I don't really believe in the ideas of fast, cheap, and easy, I do believe that we need everyone's help. And it's why I'm so focused on the school system, because eating is universal. And if the schools purchase food directly from the farmers and the ranchers and the people who take care of the land regeneratively and organically, we could change the world. And I really believe that because the values sort of come in with the food to the table. You cannot eat ripe food if it's picked, for instance, an avocado when it's not ripe in Mexico and it's shipped to this country or around the world. It's not going to ever taste like a ripe avocado picked off the tree. And it is what I fell in love with when I was in France, that seasonal eating. And it's what has made Chez Panisse what it is today, that it is always a surprise when, raspberries are over, you're into pears and apples, and then when they're over, it's springtime, and you're really connecting with nature. And she is our mother, and she is so important to the world that we live in.
You've been alluding to climate change throughout some of these questions. What do you see as your role in climate change and preventing its effects?
I'm terribly worried about climate change. Around the world, we've been seeing the disasters that have happened. And I know that regenerative agriculture can pull down the carbon into the ground where it belongs. So I have tried to think of a way to have the schools be the economic engine for making this happen. And they could be. Just think of the amount of food that is purchased for the University of California. And they have a lot of land as well. They could actually put people in business growing food for them. But the key to all of this is letting go of the middleman, the Cisco, who is asking the farmer for the wholesale price and then selling it to the schools at a retail price. When we buy food from Bob Canard directly and bring him our food compost, he is so happy to get the real cost that he needs to grow that food and to pay his farm workers. So I'm interested in this for so many reasons, and taste, not the least of them, but the most important is climate, and it's re-engaging students with nature. So that's my big goal, and I am planning a big event in Washington at the beginning of October, and hopefully we can have a long table down the mall and feed the farmers and the teachers as our most important citizens in this country and around the world.
And what's the event called for people that might want to learn about it?
Climate Food Hope. And I am sure that we will find the most amazing cooks from around the world to cook a school lunch that fits into the reimbursement from the USDA. That's what I want to demonstrate, that we can actually cook affordable, delicious food. And we've been experimenting with those 1,000 teenagers at the middle school in Berkeley, aptly named Martin Luther King Jr. Middle School, because they have 1,000 teenage students. And those students, when they cook the food, they all eat it. When they grow it and cook it, they just are overwhelmed by that creative process.
So when you're thinking about climate change, which do you see as being the more beneficial to your efforts, a vegan diet, a vegetarian diet, or a local diet?
Local is most important, but it has to always be regenerative organic, period. That's the bottom line. But I tend to eat a lot of vegetables because I love them. But we do need animals grazing on the land. And I've seen it done effectively. We do buy meat from Stemple Creek, and I've gone up to their ranch. They have a regenerative cover crop, and the cattle graze on the land. And it is important that we don't have land that's dried up, like in many places in Africa, where there used to be animals grazing. They need to be doing that for climate change, but not doing it in pens, doing it free range, and really helping to fertilize the land. And I am convinced that we do need those animals for climate change.
When I talk to people that are in the food industry or are chefs or cooks, I ask them, what do you think about formal cooking training? Is it necessary for people that want to go into that industry?
Well, I think that you can learn by doing. I mean, you make a lot of mistakes when you do that, but I think apprenticing in a restaurant that you like is a great idea. But I was inspired by a group of cooks that just kind of taught themselves French and Italian and Indian all around the world. There are very simple cookbooks, but the key to it all is going and buying food that is, as I said, organic from the farmers market, eating seasonally. I think you can learn more by going to a great farmers market than you can by going into a kitchen. It's worthwhile to do it, but I don't think it's in any way essential to being a good cook.
So tell us about one of your new projects. I mean, you've had a pretty busy couple of years and with many projects, but I want to know about the Alice Waters Institute for Edible Education at UC Davis.
Well, the university asked me if I would be interested in building an institution for cooking at the university campus in Sacramento. It's called Aggie Square. And I really spent a year sort of dreaming about what it could look like and how we could inspire people and train people to cook in schools food that was purchased locally and again organically and regeneratively. And so that was my whole goal, was creating that space that would inspire food service directors and where we could bring people that we knew from around the world to teach how to cook affordable food. But it's just important right now that we do a demonstration and people can understand these ideas immediately. And whereas I absolutely want an institute, I want a demonstration right now. And that's why I'm focused on the mall in Washington.
You also recently opened a new restaurant at the Hammer Museum in Los Angeles, and it was with David Tanis, who worked at Chez Panisse. It's called Lulu, but I want to know, when was the first time that you met David Tanis?
I met David Tanis probably in the first 5 years of Chez Panisse. That's probably 50 years ago at least. And he was a friend that would cook at the restaurant. And then he worked in the cafe upstairs when we started that 10 years later. And ultimately, he became the head chef downstairs. So I knew that he had that great experience, but we've always been very close as friends. And when the head of the Hammer Museum called me in the first year of the pandemic, and she said, "Would you be interested in doing a restaurant?" I was so surprised. I've always loved the idea of doing a restaurant in a museum. And I've had a couple of offers around the world, and they didn't work out for one reason or another. But I just thought if I could find somebody to run the restaurant and somebody I love to cook, I'd do it. And I called David Tanis and Jesse McBride, and they both said, "Well, let's try it." And we got a group of friends who gave us money, and we made the restaurant called it Lulu after our mentor Lulu Perro from Domaine Tempier in the south of France.
And before we go today, I want to ask about the bookshelf right behind you. It's so impressive. I want you to pick out three books from the bookshelf that you think that we should all get into.
That's funny. I have to go over to the other shelf, and you'll see this Elizabeth David book is falling apart. But it was the first cookbook I got, French Provincial Cooking. And all of her books, she wrote them back in let's see when this was published. I can't even remember, 1967. And a friend of mine gave me her books, and the books of Richard Olney were very important at the beginning. Their understanding of nature and connecting with seasonality was just so explicit, and so their writing is so beautiful and enticing that I sort of fell in love with all of their books first. I read Diana Kennedy's books back then too, and Paula Wolford. She wrote about Morocco. Diana Kennedy wrote about Mexico, and with such beautiful words that we started incorporating those dishes into the cooking at Chez Bernice.
Well, Alice Waters, it's been fantastic to talk to you today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was my interview with food activist and the founder of Chez Panisse, Alice Waters. News Nerds is produced and hosted by me. We're on the web at newsnerdspodcast.com, where you can catch up on episodes you missed, subscribe to our newsletter, and contact us. Find News Nerds on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, and while you're there, please leave us a review. We're also on community radio station KGVM every other Thursday at 5:30 p.m. Mountain Time. They're at kgvm.org or 95.9 FM on your radio. Consider supporting the station at kgvm.org/support-kgvm. Special thanks this week to Mr. Asterson and Profe Jordan for letting me record at school. Thanks. Thanks so much for being with us.